On the 17th of October, 1685, Louis XIV would actually finally outrightly revoke the Edict of Nantes in 1598. He revoked all of the legal concessions which had been given to Protestants by Henry IV, and he promptly dispatched dragoons to Languedoc and other areas where there were large Huguenot populations in the south of France. Again, this would produce mass conversions and further emigration, more refugees leaving France. Now, there are four points that I think need to be stressed about Louis XIV's anti-Huguenot policies. First of all, they clearly hurt France. To repress and to persecute the Huguenots was to drive out scores of talented and productive citizens, and there's a sense in which this is a fairly clear net economic loss. However, and this is the second point, I think the scale of that loss has to be kept inside of proper proportions. Expelling the Huguenots did not ruin the French economy by doing something like undermining the middle class or something like that. These ideas may have been popular 50 years ago, but historians don't give them any credence anymore. Third of all, this is the next point, Louis's anti-Huguenot policies gave him an international reputation as a nasty guy, as a despot, as a tyrant. You'll recall from our earlier lectures when talking about England in the later 17th century that a lot of the fears of English Protestants about English Catholics were intensified by the news that they were hearing about how awfully Louis XIV treated French Protestants. But fourthly, this is the last point, and maybe it's even the crucial point about Louis's anti-Huguenot policies, and that's that they were popular. They were extremely popular among most of the French population. Indeed, the provincial estates of Languedoc had already banned all Huguenots from their meetings in the year 1648. Provincial courts had banned Huguenot worship in at least 135 communities between 1660 and 1662 alone. And in 1679, the Parlement of Toulouse, the leading law court in the province of Languedoc, positively demanded anti-Huguenot edicts from the crown. Thus, there's a sense in which by repressing Protestantism, the crown could not only count on the support of local elites, it was actually catering to their desires and quite frankly, to their bigotry. And here again, there are very interesting parallels with anti-Catholicism in England. In both countries, the religious minority in question was small and politically speaking, no threat and almost insignificant, but the fear of them was intense, and for the crown to come down on them, to persecute them ruthlessly, was actually widely popular among the mass of the political nation. At least as far as the majority of the French people were concerned, the repression of the Huguenots did not represent tyranny. Last feature, the last way in which Louis was able to translate his own aspirations towards greater royal power into terms which were attractive to provincial elites was simply by working with provincial agencies. Again, there's a familiar contrast. Before 1660, the French crown tended to supersede established bodies to try and intimidate them, and this led those provincial bodies to respond with defiance, with open rebellion in a few occasions. After 1660, the crown became politically more astute. The crown made it clear that it would not tolerate independent assertions of authority on the part of provincial elites or provincial institutions, but nevertheless, in exchange for political loyalty, in exchange for obedience, the crown would work with these traditional bodies. The Parlement of Toulouse, the leading law court, was given an important role in managing the provinces. The provincial estates would be given important regulatory powers in the tax administration. It has to be stressed that in both cases, this activity was not independent. All of these institutions still worked under the supervision of the crown. But again, as I said before, regulatory power is still power, and it gave the estates and the Parlement considerable influence. The general pattern, which we've seen before, is the establishment of clear lines of authority which minimize factional infighting, the abandonment of random and ad hoc measures, and a regularization of the relationship between the monarchy and the crown. This then concludes our discussion of early modern France. Indeed, it concludes the last of our case studies, if you will, of the parts of Europe we've looked at during the wars of religion. I think in the time that remains, it's appropriate to try to offer at least a few reflections on the period as a whole and to ask ourselves what kind of legacy did the 16th and the 17th centuries bequeath to the modern world. The first point I think I'd like to make is by recalling the fact that we began at the very beginning of these lectures with a kind of theoretical distinction between constitutionalism on the one hand, the idea that sovereignty inheres in the body of the people and the monarch is responsible to them, and absolutism on the other hand, the idea that no, it's the monarch who has all the sovereignty and is responsible to God alone.